Hello, everybody, and thanks for turning on The Blender, the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Grant Podalko, an editor at RFERL.org, and I'll be your host this week. On this week's show, we profile David Hallberg, a celebrated American ballet dancer who's about to do something that no other American ballet dancer has ever done before. On November 4th, he'll become the first foreign member of Russia's legendary Bolshoi Ballet Company.
He just has beautiful feet, a very princely, noble line. He's got a very elegant bearing, and there's a kind of an effortless quality about his dancing.
We take a look at Afghanistan's fledgling filmmaking industry and the challenges faced by the producers of Neighbor. It's a new movie that tells the story of the alleged massacre of 600 Afghan inmates at an Iranian detention center in the 1990s.
A lot of people was saying that it was our responsibility to make this film. And this is our responsibility for our cinema to tell these kind of stories to our nation.
We discuss the case of Yuri Lushkov, the colorful former mayor of Moscow, who finds himself in hot water that he says was brought about by a rather frank interview he gave to Radio Free Europe's Russian service.
If Lushkov's criticism of United Russia now as being a faceless bureaucratic party that just serves the presidential administration, I would ask him, where was that criticism over the past decade when it was also doing the same thing when he was one of its founders?
And we travel to the Central Asian nation of Kyrgyzstan, where a presidential election on October 30th holds promise for a welcome dose of stability following 18 months of unrest in the wake of the ouster of former President Kurmanbek Bakiyev. But a brutal murder case is casting a shadow over the vote.
There was this sense that the Bakiyevs didn't especially try to hide that they were the ones who killed Medet Chokanovich, because their goal was to frighten absolutely everyone.
For the first time in its more than 200 years of history, Russia's legendary Bolshoi Ballet is welcoming an American into its ranks. When David Hallberg leaps onto the Moscow stage on November 4th, he will do so with the shadows of Soviet defectors dancing in the wings and with a chance to leave his mark on one of the jewels of Russian culture. Correspondent Richard Solash reports.
The Bolshoi stage is so huge that it can be a little intimidating at times, says American dancer David Hallberg. The amount of space you have to cover and the size of the jump you have to accomplish. But I'm a tall dancer and I have long legs, so hopefully I'll be able to fit those shoes, the soft-spoken 29-year-old adds. The leap Hallberg is making is indeed large, but the shoes he is hoping to fill have never before existed. On November 4th, he will make his debut in Moscow as the first foreign member of Russia's legendary Bolshoi Ballet Company, entering a rarefied space at the very core of Russia's artistic heart. His hiring provides a counterpoint to the storied defections by Soviet dancers during the 1960s and 70s. It was, in fact, exactly 50 years ago that the man many call the greatest male dancer in history, Rudolf Nureyev, stepped off a plane in Paris and slipped through the grasp of the USSR. Hallberg doesn't see his reverse journey as the equivalent, but he does acknowledge its significance.
It's an interesting full circle, in my opinion. It's not as dramatic, I think, as the defection of Nureyev or the defection of Brezhnikov, but it's still very important because there's a foreign premiere at the Bolshoi Theater, and not only a foreign premiere, but one that is American, no less. You know, I feel a deep sense of responsibility to do this justice.
The relationship between Russia and America is in constant evolution, Hallberg adds, and I can only just try to be some sort of ambassador to that relationship. Born in the sparsely populated state of South Dakota, the lanky American says he was first inspired by the Hollywood movie dancing legend Fred Astaire. He took up tap dancing at the age of 10 and only began ballet training at the age of 13, after his teacher recognized that he had the ideal physique and natural ability. After training in Arizona, as well as in Paris and New York, Hallberg joined New York's American Ballet Theater in 2001. Within 4 years, he had been promoted to principal dancer. The idea to hire Hallberg at the Bolshoi came from Sergei Filin, who became the company's artistic director in March. Filin offered the American a coveted principal dancer spot just 1 month later, but after watching Hallberg's progress for years. Someone else who has been following Hallberg is Sarah Kaufman, the ballet critic for The Washington Post. She says he is obviously one of the great male dancers in the world.
He just has beautiful beautiful feet, very princely, noble line. He's got a very elegant bearing, and there's a kind of an effortless quality about his dancing. So he doesn't force things. He doesn't screw himself up before a turn. He doesn't grimace or have any of the other kinds of faults that you sometimes see in male dancers. Additionally, the real strength he has is in his dramatic approach to dancing. He really wants to invest himself in a character, and that's what makes his performances so compelling.
Kaufman thinks Phelan recognized the Bolshoi's shortage of superior male dancers and saw a place for Hallberg. But actually inviting Hallberg to become a member of the troupe was a move the dancer himself admits was a bold statement, one he says might suggest a culture shift at the elite company.
The Bolshoi is an amazingly historic entity. It's based on such tradition, and I feel that given this type of move, it's really opening up its doors not just to me, which I'm grateful for, but also to tell the dance world and to tell the world that it's recognizing the globalization of the art form.
Asked if he has heard of any dissent within the company about the decision to take on an American dancer, Hallberg demurred and said he is quite naive about the internal politics of the Bolshoi administration. But he also points out that Phelan had the approval of the state-owned company's overlords before he offered the position. At his own request, Hallberg will remain a part-time principal at the American Ballet Theater while also holding the rank at the Bolshoi. Dance critic Kaufman agrees that Hallberg's hire is a milestone, and she believes it reflects a decade of gradual changes at the Bolshoi. The Cold War is over now. The Bolshoi is not the closed-off fortress that we may think of it as, she says. Much of that change is attributable to dancer and choreographer Alexei Ratmansky, who spent years in the West before returning to run the company. Nevertheless, dance world observers don't expect it to open the floodgates for foreigners. Katerina Navikova, a spokesperson for the Bolshoi Theater, says the company will maintain its tradition of selecting 90% of its vast core of dancers from its in-house ballet academy. With well over 200 members, the Bolshoi is the largest ballet company in the world. Navikova said Hallberg was invited to join because of his extraordinary talent, and she believes his presence will give the whole company a lift after he's had a chance to prove himself.
Some people might be very friendly, some people might be jealous, some people might feel competitive, but overall for the company development is always a great step when you invite a great dancer to join the company. But as soon as you do show your qualities, which are unbeatable and which are good, and your technique, I think there are no question why you are with the company. As soon as you have a great dancer in the company, the whole company pulls up. So this is always a very good mood.
Hallberg's debut will come just 1 week after the 19th Century Ballet and Opera House is reopened, following a rocky 6-year restoration. President Dmitry Medvedev will officially open the building on October 28th in a grand ceremony that organizers hope will repair an image tarnished by delays, budget overruns, and an embezzlement scandal. Hallberg has little time to think about all of that, however, describing himself as consumed by the prospect of starting with the company. His first ballet will be Giselle, in which he plays Albrecht, a character Hallberg says dances to live and dances to his death. The character was one of Mikhail Baryshnikov's signature roles. In his first few performances, Hallberg says he'll be measuring the Moscow audience, adapting his style to his fellow dancers, and pushing myself to the limit. But he also has ambitious long-term goals. I want to walk away from the experience with a completely different texture of my life and my career, he says. But I also want to show the ballet world that nothing is impossible.
That was correspondent Richard Solosh reporting. The past decade has seen a remarkable upsurge in Afghan filmmaking. But as the controversies surrounding two recently released films show, the nascent industry is under increasing threat from neighborhood interference. Correspondent Frood Bejan reports.
Great desert surrounds the camp, a forbidding compound of watchtowers, mud walls, and razor wire. Dozens of makeshift tents dot the sands inside the compound, where hundreds of refugees lie in human excrement and filth. This ominous setting provides the backdrop for the film Neighbor, which portrays the alleged massacre of hundreds of Afghan migrants at a detention center inside Iran in the 1990s. According to the film, Iranian guards helped to massacre about 600 Afghan inmates at the White Rock detention facility after they protested against their treatment. No independent investigation of what happened at White Rock has ever been permitted, so the facts of the case cannot be verified. But those who escaped provide a chilling testimony. To acclaimed Afghan film director Siddiq Barmak, who produced Neighbor, it was a story that needed to be told.
A lot of people was saying that it was our responsibility to make this film. And this is it is our responsibility for our cinema to tell these kind of stories to our nation.
But he says the Iranian authorities have mounted a determined effort to prevent the movie from getting wider distribution in Afghanistan, with a measure of success so far. The scheduled premiere of Neighbor at a human rights film festival in Mazar-e-Sharif earlier this month was cancelled after protests from the Iranian consulate, which had labelled the film un-Islamic. Similar objections were voiced in Kabul, where Barmak says the film was briefly screened and warmly received by the audience.
Everybody was appreciate the film and they welcomed, and it was a big, huge impact on the audience.
But the filmmaker says he has had no luck gaining wider distribution.
The screening of the film for a few TV channels, private TV channels in Kabul, but unfortunately, and the last minutes, they refused.
Again, Barmak sees the hand of Iran. He says the attempted censorship of the film sets a dangerous precedent. Neighbor was made on a budget of just $50,000. It follows the plight of Omar, the central character who is trapped at the detention center with his sick wife and two daughters. Daoud Azimi was one of the few refugees who managed to escape and survive the atrocity that day. Speaking to RFE RL's Radio Free Afghanistan, he recalls how he fled to the surrounding mountains with his wife and child after the camp was overrun by Iranian forces. "The guards started shooting at all of us," Azimi says. "In the chaos that followed, people were trying to hide and others were running away towards the mountains leading back to Afghanistan." More than a decade later, Daoud is reliving the traumatic experience, again as an actor in Neighbor. "It feels strange, but I chose this role," he says. "Now I have the opportunity to show the world what they did and how they treated us." The controversy surrounding Neighbor comes as another Afghan film was barred from screening this month in Kabul. The premiere of Madrasa was suddenly cancelled at the French Cultural Center in Kabul. The film follows the story of Mina, an 8-year-old Afghan refugee who is prevented from attending school by officials in Iran. She dreams of becoming a doctor, but anti-migrant laws prevent her from getting a good education. Asad Sikandar, director of Madrasa, says the Afghan authorities prevented the movie from being shown by the request of the Iranian embassy in Kabul.
The Iranian embassy, together with Latif Ahmadi, head of Afghan film, received notice not to screen our film. If they are saying that there is freedom, why don't they allow me to show my film?
Members of the Afghan parliament joined Sikandar in condemning the actions of the government. But during a parliamentary session on October 15, Information and Culture Minister Saeed Makhtoom Rahim denied Sikandar's claims, insisting that the government played no role. Although Afghan cinema has made impressive strides in the past decade, Siddiq Barmak, the producer of Neighbor, says huge challenges remain. He says the Afghan government must recognize the value of cinema and allocate sufficient funds to boost its growth.
A lot of young, talented filmmakers who are looking for help from some places, especially from the government, they don't receive any help. Now they are making the short films with $100 or $200.
In a country where most of the population remains illiterate, Barmak says cinema can play an important role in slaking ordinary people's thirst to be informed and educated, even when the truth is bitter.
That was correspondent Frood Bejan reporting.
Just a reminder that The Blender is the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe. RFE brings radio, internet, and television news programming to 21 countries across the former Soviet Union, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, Iraq, and the Balkans. If you'd like to get in touch, it's very easy. Drop us a line at podcasts@rfrl.org or leave a comment on the Blender section of our website. And remember, you can download episodes of The Blender from our website or by subscribing on iTunes. A new episode is posted every Friday.
Yuri Lushkov, Moscow's colorful former mayor, has been summoned by investigative authorities in Moscow to testify as a witness in a probe of a city bank that allegedly issued a fraudulent loan to a firm supposedly connected to Lushkov's wife. Lushkov says the summons is politically motivated and linked it to a frank interview he gave to our Russian service, Radio Liberty. In the interview, Lushkov was critical of Russia's ruling party, United Russia, and of President Dmitry Medvedev. Brian Whitmore, author of our popular Power Vertical blog, joined producer Pavel Butorin in the Blender studios to discuss Lushkov's predicament.
Welcome to the Blender, Brian.
Thanks for having me, Pavel.
Let's get right to it. Yuri Lushkov rules the Russian capital for 18 years, then falls out of grace, becomes a Kremlin critic, and now is summoned for questioning in an embezzlement case. And there's some likelihood, as I see it, that he may become a suspect. And he says it all started after his interview with Radio Liberty, our Russian service. Let's play a soundbite from that interview to get us started.
Medvedev has proven to be incapable of addressing the country's problems. His appointment as prime minister will be as dramatically negative for Russia as his presidency has been until now. Medvedev is not ready for governing the country at the highest state level.
Lushkov went on to say that United Russia party leaders are weak, gray, in terms of their intellectual potential, he said. And he said that the party is only serving the presidential administration and its leader, Boris Gryzlov, is incapable of thinking independently. So he said all these things, and then now he's summoned for questioning. What do you make of all this? Without getting into too much detail about the embezzlement case, which has to do with the Bank of Moscow, what's at stake here?
Well, I think Lushkov's claim that the reason he was called into questioning was an interview he gave to Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty is patently ridiculous. I think he's no idiot, and he saw this was coming down. This is not the first time we've heard about these allegations. This is not the first time we've heard about a potential investigation into Lushkov and his activities as mayor of Moscow. He had to know this was coming. He gave the interview to Radio Free Europe, and then he had a convenient excuse afterwards. So first of all, I think that claim is just ridiculous. Equally so, his claims that United Russia is just a faceless bureaucratic party that serves the Kremlin. Well, the party was the same way when Lushkov was one of its leaders. So where was his criticism of the party 1 year ago or 2 years ago?
Wasn't he one of the founders?
He was one of the founders.
Yeah, yeah.
He was actually
He founded Fatherland.
Yes, back in 1999, together with Yevgeny Primakov and Vladimir Yakovlev, he founded the then opposition party. It was in opposition to Boris Yeltsin's Kremlin. He founded Fatherland All Russia and had designs in the presidency himself, either him or Primakov. And a lot of us that were covering Russia at the time thought they might just succeed. As soon as Putin was appointed prime minister and it was clear that the elite was coalescing around him, Lushkov quickly gave up his ambitions and quickly got in line. And Fatherland All Russia was then later merged into pro-Putin party Unity, which became United Russia. So if Lushkov's criticism of United Russia now as being a faceless bureaucratic party that just serves the presidential administration, I would ask him, where was that criticism over the past decade when it was also doing the same thing when he was one of its founders?
Precisely. In another interview that followed the interview to our Russian service, I don't know if he saw it, it was with Rain TV. Lushkov said that there is what he called a property redistribution frenzy in Moscow, and they just forced him out to take care of that. And he said that people who had to divvy it up property, and the rest of Russia are now, you know, splitting property inside Moscow. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that's business as usual, and I think that's what happened when Lushkov became mayor of Moscow in the early 1990s. When you have a change of a leadership in a Russian region, there is always some kind of property redistribution, because political power and economic power and business power are tightly bound together in Russia. So it should come as no surprise to anybody that when Lushkov goes out, all of the property arrangements that he created in this kind of political economic machine that was the Moscow government are going to be redistributed. That's par for the course.
And it's hard to see him as a, you know, as a paragon of virtue in this.
So that's to put it mildly.
Let me ask you this: it seems hard for many people not to draw parallels between Lushkov and Khodorkovsky, which, you know, is a bit of a stretch, I guess, because, you know, Lushkov hasn't been charged with anything and Khodorkovsky is in jail. But is that comparison even fair, in your opinion?
Only to a point. Look, in the 90s, there were a lot of people who thought Khodorkovsky should have been prosecuted. He wasn't prosecuted in the 90s. When he was prosecuted, ironically, was when he began to clean up, or after he had cleaned up his act, basically. When I interviewed Khodorkovsky in March of 2000, right before Putin was elected president. He was already the acting president. And Khodorkovsky told me he understood that things were changing now. The rules of the game were changing, and that he could no longer, not just him, but all of the oligarchs of the 90s had to understand that in the new environment, they couldn't rely on their Kremlin contacts to create business success. They had to create successful businesses. And they had to, and people started to have to pay their taxes. And it was, and I was, to be quite frankly, was skeptical at the time. And I wrote a very skeptical article about Yukos cleaning up its act at the time. But, you know, I'm happy to be have proven wrong. Khodorkovsky did clean up his company. He did begin paying taxes. And for that very reason, he became a threat to Putin's Kremlin. Because the last thing you need, the last thing the Kremlin needs, is a clean, successful, independent business, least of all an oil company. And for that reason, so the irony of Khodorkovsky was that he got arrested after he had gone straight. This is not the case with Lushkov. And how Khodorkovsky has behaved post-incarceration, yes, he's become kind of a cause celeb, and he's become a symbol of the abuses of the Russian criminal justice system. And I think there's some truth to that. But I think this comparison is not correct because of the reason I just said. Khodorkovsky became at risk because he had gone straight. If you're corrupt in Russia and everybody's equally corrupt, that's a method of control the Kremlin has over not just entrepreneurs, but regional leaders. And if you step out of line politically, then you get in trouble. Or if you take too much. In the old Soviet Union, they had it wasn't a real article in the criminal code, but it was on ukral ne podolzhnosti. He stole more higher than his position allows. Mm-hmm. So as long as you play by the rules, you can be corrupt.
And what kind of reactions have you seen from the Kremlin coming with regard to this Lushkov case? The chief of staff?
The Kremlin chief of staff, Naryshkin, said, and this was the first comment other than Medvedev's when Medvedev said he was firing Lushkov back last September because he lost the trust of the president. Naryshkin said that one of the reasons he was fired, in addition to being poorly administering the city, was that he was corrupt and that there was corruption. And now, from what I understand, Lushkov's wife has threatened to sue Naryshkin over that remark. Good luck with that. But this is the first time the Kremlin's come out. The situation is clearly escalated. And to be honest, Pavel, this is what really surprises me. Lushkov wasn't born yesterday, and he didn't enter politics yesterday. And this guy knows how the game is played in Russia. And he's always historically pushed as far as he can push. But he knows when he reaches that point where he puts himself at risk, he backs off. We've seen this a couple of times. As I talked about earlier in our discussion, in the late 90s, when it became clear that it was Putin who the elite was coalescing, Lushkov quickly backed off, brought his party into Putin's party, and this is how United Russia was born. This time, he didn't really see the writing on the wall. And this is what more than anything surprises me about the whole Lushkov incident, is that he probably could have had a dignified retirement. He probably could have kept a good chunk of the business empire that was accumulated during his time as mayor of Moscow if he had only played by the rules. When Naryshkin supposedly, according to his account of their discussion, Naryshkin told him it's time to move on. It's time to retire. This is the first time I've seen him continue pushing when the writing clearly was on the wall that it was time for him to go. So that's the most surprising thing about this incident.
In the meantime, Lushkov is now in Austria, outside of Russia, while the Russian investigators are expecting him to come back to Moscow for questioning. You can read more about Russian politics on Brian's own blog, The Power Vertical, on our website. Brian, what's your latest post about?
Thanks for that question. My last couple of posts, one I just posted yesterday and one I posted earlier in the week, are about problems and discontent within the security structures of Russia, the so-called siloviki. Now it's clear that Putin is returning to the Kremlin, and one would expect that the siloviki would be jumping for joy right now. And while they're happy to have Putin returning, there are deep problems in each of the main organs of the security services.
Well, I look forward to reading that. Our listeners can also follow Brian Whitmore on Twitter at Paravertical.
Paravertical.
Okay, thank you, Brian.
Thanks, Paul.
And thank you, guys. You can read the entire Lushkov interview on our website at referl.org.
28 languages, 21 countries, one voice. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
And now to Central Asia, where voters in Kyrgyzstan are going to the polls to cast their ballots for a new president on October 30th. Many are hoping the vote will bring stability to the country, which has been plagued by unrest since the ouster of controversial President Kurmanbek Bakiyev in violent protests last year. But Bakiyev's brutal legacy and a grisly murder case are casting a shadow over the latest vote. Correspondent Daisy Sindelar has more.
There are plenty of issues on voters' minds as Kyrgyzstan goes to the polls to elect a new president. There's the stagnant economy, relations with Russia, and the potential for violent unrest in the country's troubled south. But one issue overshadowing the election stretches back to 2009, when a powerful political insider with close ties to then-president Kurmanbek Bakiyev was brutally murdered. The man, Medet Sadokulov, was tortured, strangled, and left in a car that was then set alight. Officials at the time attempted to portray his death as the result of a road accident, even arresting and jailing a driver they said was guilty of causing the crash. But people like Elmira Ibrahimova, a former deputy prime minister, say many in Bishkek saw the killing all along as the work of President Bakiyev himself, together with his powerful brothers.
There was this sense that the Bakiyevs didn't especially try to hide that they were the ones who killed Medet Chokanovich, because their goal was to frighten absolutely everyone. It worked to their advantage that everyone knew that anyone who tried to break ties with them could expect a similar fate.
Just months before his murder, Sadokulov had left his post as Bakiyev's chief of staff, saying he was disenchanted with what he saw as the deep corruption and criminality of the Bakiyev clan. Instead, he hoped to forge a new union with the political opposition, who delighted in the idea of Bakiyev's gray cardinal coming over to their side. Bakiyev, by contrast, was far from delighted. A package was delivered to Sadokulov's home containing a severed ear and finger. The sender, he believed, was Bakiyev's brother, Janish, the head of the presidential guard and the man seen as the family's uncompromising enforcer. Melis Turganbayev, a top interior ministry official, said he warned Sadokulov to be careful.
I told Medet Sadokulov quite openly that it was a warning sign, and that if they were sending such a gift, it meant that they were letting him know, in no uncertain terms, that he was out of control and that the conversation would be different the next time around. We wanted to carry out an investigation, but he refused.
It has taken more than 2 years for Bishkek to muster the political will to make strides in the murder case. Bakiyev, for one, is gone, forcibly ousted from power following violent anti-government protests last year. He now lives in self-imposed exile in Belarus, and Janish and his other brothers have left the country as well. But many of their political allies remain, and many of them, in turn, have been targeted in the investigation. This includes one of the most popular candidates in the election, Adahan Marumarov, who was serving as the head of the country's Security Council at the time of the murder, and who investigators suggest may have information about a cover-up. Critics accuse the presidential frontrunner, Prime Minister Almazbek Atambayev, of timing the investigation to work to his political advantage and to cast Bakiyev allies like Madumarov in a negative light. But others say it is time for the truth about the brutality of Bakiyev's regime to come out. A state commission reported this spring that more than 30 high-profile contract killings were committed during Bakiyev's five-year rule. This includes the murder of independent journalist Gennady Pavlyuk, who died after being thrown from a high-rise building with his arms and legs bound. Another journalist, Sirgak Abdildayev, was forced to leave the country after he was brutally beaten by thugs he believed were tied to Bakiyev. At the time of the beating, Abdildayev was working with Sadrukulov to create a website to publish what he said was damning testimony about the crimes of the Bakiyev clan.
The materials were already ready. There was enough to last at least half a year. It would have been like a bomb. Some of the information was so explosive that I understood I had gotten myself into a deadly game. Then on March 3rd, I was attacked. And on the 13th, as you know, he was killed.
Police have detained several men suspected of carrying out Sadrukulov's murder, but they acknowledge it may be impossible to extradite the men they believe may have ordered and organized the hit, Kormenbek and Janish Bakiyev. In the meantime, many people in the country are hoping the murder case will remind voters to use their ballots to keep Kyrgyzstan on a more progressive course. Ibrahimova, the former deputy prime minister, says she's putting her hopes on the wisdom of the people not to give the Bakiyevs an opportunity to return, even in another form.
That was Daisy Sindelar on the 2009 murder of former Kyrgyz presidential aide Medet Sadrukulov. The story was based on reporting by RFE's Kyrgyz service. For more coverage on the case, as well as the current elections in Kyrgyzstan, visit our website at rferl.org. And that's the podcast for this week. Thanks, as always, to Tanya Kancheva, the woman behind the glass who makes the blender come together each week, and to you for turning us on. Take care, everyone. We'll be right back.